announcement. There will be a class 2 weeks from today. There's a workshop on von Neumann algebras that week. But if you look at the original pronouncements I made, where I said we would stop during the workshop, so I had forgotten about that one. And if we stop then too, we will have one less lecture, and we want to have at least the 10 lectures. So we will continue in 2 weeks from today. We will be having a lecture, but it'll be up in the library on the Tuesday. That's the 29th, 2 weeks from today. Okay, so let me write that down. Was that October 29th or something? 30th. Next week it's here, yeah. Okay. Okay, I want to recall a bit from a couple things from the last two lectures. So one of the things I want to remember is this. The lemma I proved is that if you have a subspace, a C star algebra, and you have C, a map from A into B of H, which is unital, it's identity to identity, and is norm 1, okay, then we were able to extend that to the operator system, A plus A star into B of H, by setting C twiddle of A plus B star to be phi of A plus phi of B star, and we showed that that was well defined and positive. Okay. So we need a corollary, but I need to do a definition, because I think we've mentioned these things but never really defined it. If you have a map phi from some subspace M of a C star algebra, and phi maps M into B of H, say, then we can define these maps Cn, which are phi tensor the identity n, from n by n matrices over M into n by n matrices over B of H, which we think of operators on, this is Hn, the direct sum of n copies, by Cn of a matrix whose entries are Aij, just C of Aij. All right, so we know how to do that. And we can compute the norm of those things, and we say C is completely bounded. If the CB norm of phi, which is defined to be the supremum of the norm of phi tensor identity, is finite. And we'll also have use for the term completely contractive. We'll shorten these. This can be called CB. This can be called CC. Okay, if the CB norm is less than or equal to 1. Okay, all right. So, I get a corollary of that lemma. Which I mentioned at the time, but I didn't prove, okay, because we didn't really need it at that point, is that if we have the identity belongs to A is contained in this C star alpha squared B, C mapping A into B of H, C of 1 is the identity, and CCB is equal to 1, then that implies that map C tilde from the lemma is completely positive. Okay, CP. Okay. Well, this is really a corollary. It doesn't require much extra proof because it basically uses the same result. All right? Is because by hypothesis, this phi n, which maps this mn of m contained in mn of b to mn of b of h, which is b of h n, right, that is contractive, right? Phi n of the n by n identity is the identity, and Cn is equal to 1 by hypothesis, okay? So we apply the lemma to Cn, and then it says, therefore, this map C of n twiddle, which maps mn of A plus mn of A star into B of H by the formula Cn twiddle of a matrix Aij plus a matrix Bij, Vji star equals Cn of Aij plus Cn of Bij star. And if you work that out, that's just C of Aij plus C of Bij star. And so that is the same thing as C twiddle tensor identity, okay, of Aij plus Bji star. Okay, so when you unwind it, Cn tilde is the same as phi tilde n. So by the lemma, phi tilde n is positive for all n, and therefore it's completely positive. To apply this to get a useful corollary of the Iverson extension theorem. All right. So, Choi proved the Iverson extension theorem last time, which said that if you have a CP map from an operator system into B of H, which is completely positive, then it has a completely positive extension to B of H. Okay, well, to the C star algebra it contains, or, all right. Yeah, let me just write that here. We have S contained in A, an operator system. All right, so then we have S and some C to B of H. It's completely positive. And there exists, on that phi twiddle, a completely positive extension. Okay. So I want to use this corollary of the lemma to get a corresponding statement for unital operator algebras. Okay. So if I have one contained in A, in fact, I don't really need this, it's just a subspace. So I'm going to use it for algebras right away. Inside B, C star algebra. Okay. And I have C mapping M into B of H. C of 1 is the identity. CCB is equal to 1. We can say less than or equal to 1, but since it takes 1 to 1, it's obviously norm at least 1. Okay. Then, well, I don't know what the hell M is. I've been using M for spaces later on in my notes. okay. So, then there exists an extension, C tilde, mapping B to B of H. Completely positive, such that B twiddle restricted to A is equal to C. Okay. And the fact that it's completely positive, the norm of C twiddle CB is then C tilde of the identity, which is 1. Okay. So, how do we prove that? Well, it's easy. We use the corollary of the lemma to extend phi to phi tilde. So here we have A. Here we have phi mapping to B of H, completely contractive. This is contained in S, which is A plus A star. And now we know that this map phi twiddle now here is completely positive. And this is contained in the C star algebra. Let's use the right letter, B. Okay. And now by Arvidsson's extension theorem, I can extend this completely positive map. So this is by the lemma. Or corollary of lemma, sorry. Right. Now here I use Arvidsson extension theorem, and I get a phi, let's say phi tilde tilde, okay, which is completely positive and extends this, okay, and now, like I wrote there, phi tilde tilde of the identity is 1, and that's the CB norm of phi tilde tilde for any completely positive map. Okay. So this is this extends that, and it's completely contractive, completely positive. Okay. That says corollary of L. L being short for lemma. Let me make a remark that's worth noting, is that these extensions, these CP extensions, are generally not unique. Okay? I mean, so you have uniqueness, like we had uniqueness in the Nash's dilation of a contraction. You have uniqueness in the Steinspring dilation. If you already have a completely positive map defined on the whole C-star algebra, then the minimal dilation of that to a star representation is unique. But this extension is definitely not unique. I won't work out the details, but let me give you just an example. take A to be the set of all points Z in the circle such that 1 is less than or equal to Z is less than or equal to 2, that annulus. Okay. And we can take A to be R of A, the closure of the functions which are rational and have no poles on here. And that's the same. That's the same as in this case because it's a nice domain. The functions which are continuous on the closed annulus and analytic on the interior of the annulus. Okay. And then I can define C of F to be 1 over 2 pi I integral over, let's just be circle C1 and this circle C2, one of radius 1 and one of radius 2. Let's integrate over C1 of F of Z over Z dz. In other words, 1 over 2 pi integral from 0 to 2 pi of F of e to the I theta d theta. Well, this particular functional gives you an extension to continuous functions on the whole annulus, or let me think of this as sitting inside continuous functions on C1 union C2, because that's the minimal subset on which it sits inside isometrically by the maximum modulus principle. It has to take its maximum modulus either on the outside circle or on the inside circle. Okay. And here you have, this extends to C of C1 union C2. But because of analyticity, this is also equal to 1 over 2 pi integral from 0 to 2 pi of F of 2 e to the I theta d theta. But that gives you another way of extending this to the union of the two circles, and those are different, because on the functions which are discontinuous on the union of those two circles, there's no relationship between the inside functions and the outside functions. Okay? So the fact that these two things are equal on A is just Cauchy's theorem, right? For any analytic function, the integral, if I integrate around this circle minus the integral around that circle, I'll get zero. Okay. So that's an example where you can see this extension's not unique. Okay. I want to relate these results that we proved last time to the dilation theory that we talked about 2 weeks ago. So I start with an operator algebra. Okay. Suppose I have one belonging to a subalgebra of B, a C star algebra. Okay. And suppose I have a map rho from A into B of H, rho of 1 equals identity, a representation, okay, and let's assume, well, equal to 1. You can say less than or equal to, but, all right. Well, then, we have by dilemma, we get rho tilde maps this operator system. This is the unique, completely positive, or not completely positive, but just positive extension to that operator system. Okay. Then the following are equivalent. One, rho has a B dilation. Okay, this is the object that we were interested in. Remember, having a B dilation meant that, so here we have A contained in B, we have this map rho into B of H. I get a star representation pi from this into B of K. K containing H, containing H in a natural way, in such a way that rho of A is the projection onto H, pi of A, restricted to H for all A and A. Okay. So that's the dilation picture. Okay. So we want to know when we have such a dilation. Okay. Well, this is if and only if rho is completely contractive. And equivalently, this is true if and only if rho tilde is completely positive. Okay. So this is easy given what we know. Okay? I mean, one clearly implies 2 and 3, and they're equivalent. This is true because if you have a star dilation, star representations are completely positive and completely contractive, and this is a compression of it. So since it's a compression of a completely contractive thing, it's completely contractive, and since it's compression of a completely positive thing, it's completely positive. And the equivalence of 2 and 3 is just the corollary of lemma. Right, so this is our corollary of lemma that those two things are the same, and this is because star representations are completely positive and unital, so that implies completely contractive. So that's the easy part. So we want to show how do you go the other way. Okay, so we have. So if we have a completely contractive map, then we can extend it to a completely positive map on the operator system. So let's start there. Okay. All right. So we have A mapped by rho into B of H. This is contained in S, which is A plus A star. This is completely contractive. We get this map rho tilde, completely positive. This is contained in B. Okay. So by Arvidsson's extension theorem, we get a map C here, completely positive. So by Arvidsson extension theorem, there exists a CP map C extending rho tilde. Okay. Now that we've got this completely positive map, we now apply Steinspring's extension theorem to get it to be a piece, the corner of a star representation. We get this map pi into B of K such that C of A, or let's call it B, is equal to projection onto H, pi of B restricted H for all B and B. So now we have the star representation. Why is it a dilation of rho? Well, because when we take A and A, right, this map, we have that rho of A is pH pi of B restricted to H. That is multiplicative. Okay, that's a representation. That's what we mean by a dilation. Okay? A representation is a star dilation whose compression is this. So in fact, we know from Sanderson's theorem, in fact, that this space splits into three pieces so that when I look at it on A, its upper triangular in the 2-2 entry is rho. We don't need that here, but this is precisely the same thing as saying it's i.e. pi is a B dilation of rho. Okay. So this tells us what we should be doing if we want to understand representation theory of a non-self-adjoint operator algebra. All right? If we want to understand the representation theory of a non-self-adjoint operator algebra in terms of the way it sits inside this C star algebra B and the representations there, this shows exactly the ones which have this kind of nice dilation are the completely contractive ones. And in fact, there's a reasonable argument, which I think people in the field have adopted, is that that is the right category to be working in. Rather than studying bounded representations, one should study completely bounded representations, completely contractive representations. We will see later on, in fact, why completely bounded representations are closely related to these, because there's a theorem of Paulson that says they're similar to completely contractive ones. I won't be going there today. Okay.
So the food has nothing to do with A should be an algebra. You didn't mean a space, yeah. Being A representation.
Well, if it was a space containing the identity, yeah.
A is a space, it's not algebra. Nothing to do with the algebra, yeah.
No, but then it wouldn't be a dilation in the sense that we mean dilation if it doesn't have an algebra structure, though. That's all. Okay. All right. Now, the next thing I want to talk about is what is the right C star algebra for an operator algebra to live inside? And this goes back to Arvidsson's original work in his active paper in 67 or 69, 69, I think. Yeah. Where he proves the Arvidsson extension theorem and Arvidsson dilation theorem. He didn't call them that. but his reason for doing this was to give you an analog of the way you study function algebras for arbitrary non-commutative, possibly non-commutative algebras of operators. Now, if you look at this example I had here of the rational functions on the annulus, I could have sat that inside continuous functions on the closed annulus, and it sits inside there just fine. Okay. And it separates points and everything that function algebras are supposed to do. But the union of the two boundary circles is a better place for it to live, because somehow the information of what happens inside is extraneous. When we take this quotient map from continuous functions on the whole annulus to continuous functions on the boundary by restriction, that map is isometric on the algebra. In fact, it's completely isometric because we're working inside commutative C-star algebras, and there's a theorem of Steinspring that says that positive maps into C-star algebras are completely positive. Okay, so that subset C1 union C2 is called the Schielhoff boundary. And in fact, for any function algebra, there's always, so anytime you have a function algebra, so this is, contains the identity, this is the subalgebra of C of X, and it separates points. Okay, that's what a function algebra is. Okay. Then, in fact, I'll show you a proof later, but Schielhoff proved that there exists a unique set Y, compact subset of X, so that the restriction F in A goes to F restricted to Y in C of Y is isometric. And two, if F and A goes to F restricted to W, and C of W is isometric, then W contains Y. It's the smallest closed subset that has that. And that's the Schirra boundary. Okay? The C of Y is a quotient of C of X. Okay? Well, Arvidsson argued that there should be a quotient of the C-star algebra. Like if I have A contained in the C-star algebra B, and let's assume for convenience that the B is the C-star algebra generated by A, you may be able to do that in a number of ways, the same way you could do here. But there should be a quotient of that one, which is a canonical choice. And he wanted to call that the Schirra boundary. But he wasn't able to prove it. Okay? And 10 years later, work of Hamana on the injective envelope led to a proof of the existence of this C-star envelope. But it wasn't the proof Arvidsson wanted. Okay? Arvidsson had an approach that he laid out in his original work, which was never realized at that time. And there's now a new proof of this, and I'm going to show you this new proof today of the existence of this C-star envelope. And this proof is not in Paulson's book, okay? All right, so let's just set some notation here. So I'm starting with my subalgebra of B. The B is going to be the C-star algebra generated by A C-star algebra. Okay. And rho, mapping A into B of H, is going to be a completely contractive representation. Completely contractive unital representation. Okay? So in other words, rho of 1 is the identity, and rho of CB equals 1. Okay? And a representation. All right. If sigma is a dilation of rho, we will write rho is less than, that's sort of a curvy less than, okay? Curvy less than or equal to sigma. If sigma is a dilation of rho, in other words, and completely contractive. So, i.e., sigma maps A into B of K is a completely contractive representation, unital. And H is contained in K, and sigma of A restricted to H, project back down onto H, should be rho. Okay. All right, so now we get to some key definitions. Rho is maximal. Okay. If whenever you have rho dominated by sigma, it's in fact a direct sum. Okay? In other words, H always reduces sigma. Right. It means that sigma, so if you take your Hilbert space K and write it as H direct sum H prime, then sigma of A looks like rho of A 0, 0, sigma prime of A. Okay. That's what maximal means. So you notice that it can be maximal and still have dilations. It's just that those dilations are, in a certain sense, trivial. Okay, so you could have a dilation which was minimal and maximal, because the nomenclatures aren't exactly consistent, okay? And the other thing I want is that rho has the unique extension property. If two things happen. One, is that rho has a unique, completely positive extension to B, and two, this extension is a star representation of B. And finally, I'll say that, and this is definition due to Arvidsson, if in addition the star representation is irreducible, we say rho is a boundary representation. I don't have enough room. See, short forms are better. Okay. It is disappeared. It says that if this star representation that you get, this extension being a star representation, if that star representation is an irreducible representation, then we call rho a boundary representation of A. Yeah. I didn't know that was going to happen. All right. Sorry. Okay. So, you note that Rho has a unique CP extension to A plus A star, namely rho tilde. Okay. If it has rho or rho tilde, it has a completely positive extension, which is a star representation, then it's multiplicative, right? But conversely, if it's multiplicative, on B, it is a star representation. Okay. And it must be uniquely determined. And uniquely determined by rho, because B is the C star algebra of rho of A. So once you know it on A, if it's a star representation, it's determined on the whole C star algebra. So if every CP extension to B is multiplicative, then it's unique. Rho has the unique extension property. Okay. So the point of this is that in order to show it has a unique extension property, we just have to take any completely positive extension, which we know exists, and prove that it's multiplicative. And then it has to be the only one you could possibly get that's multiplicative.
Okay.
No. No, the point is if I can show that every extension is multiplicative, then every extension is this one. Yeah. Well, on B. Theorem I want to prove now is that if I have this sub-algebra inside this C star algebra, okay, and row mapping A into B of H is completely contractive unital representation, then row is maximal if and only if it has the unique extension property. Okay. All right. So, assume it's maximal. I'm going to extend it. I'm going to prove that the extension is multiplicative. Okay, so I've got A. Row is going into B of H here, contained in S, which is A plus A star. I have my row tilde, and this is contained in B, and I have this completely positive extension here. What do I call it? Do I call it up there anyway? No, okay. Okay. So this is a completely positive extension. All right. So, again, using the same picture I had somewhere hidden now, right? I use Stein spring to get a star representation here. And so we have that rho of A is equal to the projection onto H, pi of A restricted to H. Okay. So pi restricted to A is a dilation of rho. Okay. It didn't really matter whether it was star representation, but of course it is, and pi is completely contractive and unital because it's a star representation, and star representations are always completely contractive, and it's unital. So, rho is maximal. So, by maximality, H reduces pi of A, and hence, and so pi of B. Right? If it reduces a set of operators, it reduces the whole C star algebra they generate. So, i.e., pi of b looks like this. Pi 1 of a, but it's an extension of c, so we know what it does, right? So this is phi of a, 0, pi prime of phi of b. That better be a b. Okay. On h, direct sum h prime equals h perp, okay? So it reduces it, and this is a star representation. So since this is a star representation, that corner is a star representation because it's a sum and. Oops. Hey, it didn't break. Okay. And therefore it's unique. And a star representation. Okay. So you have unique extension property. Alright. Alright, so let's go the other way. Let's suppose that rho has unique extension property. And suppose rho dilates to a map sigma, where, okay, so sigma is a completely contractive unital representation on B of K. K contains H, and projection onto H of sigma of A restricted to H is equal to rho of A. I have to prove that sigma reduces H, so that it splits as a direct sum and. Okay. Well, we play the same game. We have A mapping sigma into B of K, and then this sits inside of B, and I can get a map phi here, a CP extension, okay, by exactly the same argument. And then I can take pi, a star representation, unto B of some K prime. So here I use Arvesen extension again in the same way, and here I use Stein spring. Okay. And I get pi is a star dilation of sigma. Okay, so sigma of A is equal to the projection onto K of pi of A restricted to K for all A and A. Now, therefore, rho of A is the projection onto H of sigma of A restricted to H. So if I restrict to K, and then I restrict to H, which is contained in K, that's just like restricting right away from pi to H, okay? So pi is also a star dilation of rho. Okay. But now, so if I, for all b and b, goes to the projection onto h, pi of b restricted to h, that's a completely positive extension of rho. Okay, because if you, I mean, the converse of Stein-Sprung's theorem is trivial. Stein-Sprung's theorem says that if you have a completely positive map, then it's the corner of a star representation. But the other way around, corner of a star representation is completely positive, is elementary, okay? And that's all I'm using here, okay? So that's a completely positive extension of rho. But rho has the unique extension property, okay? So that means there's just one of these guys, and it's a star representation, okay? So by so this is the unique CP extension of rho to B. And in particular, it is a star representation. Okay. Let me call that a name. How about a new letter? We've got pi, sigma, rho, tau. All right. Tau. Okay, so pi of B is tau now. If you think about it, this map is multiplicative here, okay? So say if pi of B were equal to tau of B x, y, some other stuff, okay, then pi of B star should be tau of B star, y star, x star, and something, and pi of B star B should be two different things. One thing is it should be from this formula, it should be tau of B star B, other stuff, which is tau of B star tau of B and other stuff. Okay. But on the other hand, it should be pi of B star, pi of B. So you've got pi of B star Y star times pi of B Y. And then up here you get, that's tau. Here you get tau of B star tau of B plus Y star Y. These two things have to be equal. So Y is zero. Okay, so that's zero. But then multiplying B and B star on the other side, we get the same thing except we get an X star there. So the fact that you have a star representation like this, which has a corner which is a star representation, means that these are zero. So we have a star representation which splits like that, okay? All right. So that means that H reduces pi, and therefore it reduces sigma. So rho is maximal. The next thing is to show that we have these things. arguing for time. It's 5 past. Let's take a 5-minute break. Start at 10 past. Okay, start again. So the theorem is that every unit or completely contractive representation rho from A into B of H has a maximal dilation. Right? Where you remember that maximal doesn't mean that it's the largest one, but that it has this maximality property that anything bigger is just the direct sum end. And it's no. I don't even know if it's unique. But I'm not going to prove it's unique. Yeah, and that could be also maximal. So in that sense, yeah. But there could, but yeah, if you wanted a unique one, it'd have to be the minimal maximal. Okay. In other words, you take the maximal dilation, and then you would take the Hilbert space generated by sigma of A applied to H, and take that restriction. That would be a minimal maximal, but I don't think that's unique either. I haven't really thought about it though. All right. So you have to be a little cagey about this. So this is due to Mitchell and McCullough. And they have a paper on the archive of a few years ago that has boundary representation in the title that you could find that has this in it. You can also find sort of a proof in the separable case in Arvidsson's paper, which has boundary representations in the title, that's this year. His proof's a little cleaner, I guess, except it's in a separable case, but it's easy to see that if it weren't separable, you could do the same thing. He wanted to know that if it was separably acting, separable algebra, then you could dilate it to a maximal thing on a separable space. And if you look at the proof, you'll see that you can do that. All right. So suppose I have A and A and C and H. We'll say that a dilation sigma of rho is maximal at this pair AC if whatever sigma is dilated to some tau, then sigma of AC has the same norm as tau of A, C. Okay. So just, and it's maximal at a set of, it's also say maximal at some subset S contained in A cross H if it's maximal at each point in S. Okay. So the first goal is to dilate it so that it's maximal at a point, and then dilate it so that it's maximal at A cross H, and then dilate it some more. All right. So the idea is that we first want to find rho equals rho 0 . We want to find successive completely contractive dilations so that each rho n plus 1 of AC is close to the soup of over all sigma which dominate rho n of sigma of A, C. Well, if we could get equality, we could do it in one step, but let me just make that bigger, subtract off 1 over n. So how do you do that? Well, suppose you have rho n. Then you look at all of these representations sigma, which are dilations, and you have a certain soup. You can get as close to that soup as you like, so you pick one. Yes? Oh, yeah, my apologies. Yeah, I have no idea if you could make it exactly. Obviously. Yeah, of course. It could already be right on. Yes. Okay. So, but basically by definition, you always do that, and it's not too hard to see that in a separable case, you could do this with a separable extension. So, so we find those like that, and then you get a representation rho. So say rho n acts on Hn, where you have the original H was H0, contained in H1, contained in H2. So we let H just be the union of those Hn's, close it up to complete it to get a Hilbert space. You define rho of A to be the join of these rho n's. So that defines A on a dense subspace, and it's completely contractive, so it extends by uniqueness. So we obtain a dilation rho. That's rho is a bad letter. Did I say rho? Let's call it sigma. All right. Excuse me. So we obtain a rho less than sigma. All right, because it has this dilation property that we want, and clearly sigma of A will have to equal the soup over all tau greater than or equal to sigma of tau of A xc, because it's already obtained within 1 over n by the compression to Hn. All right, so I can dilate it to be maximal at one point, okay? But now you can take a dense subset of points. Like, for instance, I could take all of A cross H if I'm not worried about cardinality, and I can successively dilate it for each one, and eventually, after a very long time, I get a dilation which is maximal at A cross H, right? So I repeat. Obtain a dilation no less than sigma, such that sigma is maximal at A cross H. Okay. All right. So say on a space, let's call it sigma 1. Say on a space K1 containing H. Okay. Well, the next part is easier, all right? Then I dilate sigma n to a sigma n plus 1. Sigma n plus 1 maximal on A cross Kn. So I get an increasing sequence of Hilbert spaces, and my algebra is maximal on the previous Hilbert space. And now I take the union again. So I take K to be the union of these Kn's, n greater or equal to 1, close that up. I take a tau, which is defined by tau restricted to Kn, sigma n. So these are all completely contractive, so you can check that tau is completely contractive representation. And now tau dilates it. So we have rho is a dilated to tau, and tau is maximal on the union of A cross Kn, n greater or equal to 1. And of course, we can close that up, and that's A cross K. So it's maximal on the whole thing. Okay. So that means that tau is maximal, because if you try to dilate it, this sort of nowhere to go except adding a direct sum. Tau is maximal. Okay? Because if I have, suppose tau is dominated by some other representation pi, and I have A and A and XC in this Hilbert space K on which tau acts, well then I know that tau of A XC is equal to pi of A XC. Right? That's this maximality property. So if I if this pi is acting on k direct sum k prime, then pi of A looks like you've got tau of A here in the 1-1 entry, and then what can it have down here? It can't have anything there. Right? It's a zero there. That's what this says. It says if I look at tau of A and pi of A, what they do to any vector C is the same norm. So I can't send it to anywhere here except to zero. And it's a star representation, so the same is true for adjoints. I have that there. And there's your maximality property. All right. So therefore, pi looks like tau direct sum pi prime. And that's the maximality. Okay. So we know that maximal ones exist, and we know that the maximal representations are the same as the ones with this unique extension property. So now we know that there are dilations which have a unique extension property. It doesn't really matter. You could do transfinite induction. All right, you could list all the elements of that set of A cross H. Yeah, but that's pretty straightforward in this case. The point is that we're not adding new stuff. We're only doing maximality over the points we've got, right? Okay. All right. I'm not supposed to erase. That doesn't matter. Do this. All right. So if A is a unital operator algebra, okay. So for us at this point, this is a concrete unital operator algebra, so it's contained inside a C-star algebra. Okay. Then the C-star envelope of A, if it exists, and that's what we want to prove, is a C-star algebra A and a completely isometric algebra isomorphism, algebra monomorphism. J, say, from A into A, such that two things. One, of course, so the important thing is that this is completely isometric, all right? A should be the C star algebra generated by J of A. And that's easy to come by. That could be any C star algebra which contains it completely isometrically. But the important thing is that whenever you have A and K, a complete isometry, completely isometric embedding this into K of A contained in B, which is the C star algebra of K of A. Okay. And we have this injection J into A. There should exist naturally unique star homomorphism pi of B onto A so that this diagram commutes. So what's this saying? This is saying that among all C star algebras that contain A completely isometrically, there's a smallest one. And that whenever you're contained in some other one, there's a quotient map onto this smallest one, which is, so the composition is this natural complete isometry on A. Pardon? Yes.
The K need not go inside B, right? Because if there are any extra C's out of there.
Well, oh, it's not this B.
Your K must be.
Does any C star algebra?
The same B. It need not be going to the same B.
I'd forgotten that I had it sticking inside B there. All right. All right. So the C star envelope exists. All right, so we start with the natural injection. All right, we start with I'll start with any row into B, sort of equals C star algebra of row of A, where row of A is any row is any completely isometric isomorphism. Okay, into. All right, so that's a representation. We can sit this side inside B of H. Okay, and now I can take a maximal dilation . Okay, so we have sigma from A into some B of K, and this is a unital, completely contractive representation, and it's maximal. All right, and I'm going to let A be that I want to be the C-star envelope to be the C-star algebra of sigma of A. Okay. And this map J is just sigma. I'm going to prove that. You guys are impatient. All right. So suppose I have some other one. Suppose I have A, and I have K, and this is sending it into C star algebra of K of A, and then again that's complete isometry. Yeah, I mean, by the way, I mean, this is a completely contractive extension, but rho is already completely isometric, so of course the norm of sigma is bigger, so it's completely isometric, right? Because rho is. All right. Well, then I can define a map from K of A sitting inside C star algebra of K of A over to sigma of A. I'm ready to call it J of A, but that doesn't matter. All right, by sigma composed with K inverse. So this is a complete isometric, completely isometric isomorphism. This is sitting inside of A. All right. All right. And let me think of this as sitting inside of B of H. Okay. So I can take this representation and I can find a star. I can use the Arvidsson's dilation theorem to find a star dilation of this onto a bigger Hilbert space. Okay. So this is a star dilation of sigma composed with K inverse. Okay. So this is by Arvidsson's dilation theorem here. Okay. So in particular, pi restricted to K of A there is a dilation of sigma composed with K inverse. Okay. So where pi composed with K dominates sigma. Okay. But sigma is maximal. Okay. So therefore, pi composed with K of A reduces the Hilbert space H. So, by exactly the same argument as I went through up there, still on the board, I can just restrict it to this reducing subspace, and I get a star representation here. Okay. So, pi restricted to H is a star representation. Okay. But where does it go? It doesn't go into B of H. It goes because pi of K of A is equal to sigma of A for all A in A. So pi of C star algebra of K of A is then is equal to the C star algebra of sigma of A is A. So this is a star representation. I use it as a star representation onto A. Okay, it doesn't go into B of H, it goes into A. Okay. All right. And, well, uniqueness is easy. I think maybe I won't do uniqueness, but it's the standard uniqueness thing. If I got two of these things, I have the identity map that goes between the two copies of A, that must extend to a star representation from each of the C star envelopes onto the other, and their inverses are star representations, which are the identity on a generating subset. So they're they're inverses of each other. In other words, the two algebras are star isomorphic in the right way. Yeah. Well, you first prove it exists. It's usually easy then. All right. It's an exercise. Easy exercise. Okay. QED. All right. And let me mention a remark. Arvidsson, in his 2007 archives paper, says that if A is separable, A is separable, then there is a family of boundary representations. Say rho alpha, so that direct sum of the rho alphas is completely isometric. So the C star envelope of A in this case can be obtained as the C star algebra of this direct sum. So it's important to Bill that there'd be these irreducible ones, but unfortunately it doesn't follow from this proof that there are any irreducible maximal representations, only that there are maximal representations. And if you start with a completely isometric one and dilate it, you get a completely isometric maximal representation, and then the C star algebra that image generates is always the C star envelope. But you don't get the existence of any irreducible ones. And Arvidsson's argument is a direct integral decomposition, where he shows that in the separable case, using some separable polar spaces and decomposition of bases, he can decompose this as a direct integral of representations which are almost everywhere irreducible maximal representations, hence boundary representations. We're not going to go into that. It's kind of technical, and I'm not so sure it's key. It's nice to know, but it's not known in a non-separable case. It's good homework. Arvidsson says he's been trying to do that for 40 years and hasn't done it, but give it a shot. That's good. Okay.
So what's wrong in the market? You take all boundary representation there. You go right there.
Well, you have to know that there are enough to make it completely isometric. I mean, but the point of boundary representations, as opposed to just the unique extension property, is that this star representation has to be irreducible, right?
You take all of them, what will happen?
Sure, you can take all of them. There's nothing wrong with taking all of them into some fixed Hilbert space of the appropriate size. The question is, why are there enough of them to be completely isometric? That's what's not obvious, and that's in fact not even known in the non-technical case. Well, sure, yeah. So if that's... Yeah, but that's not the point. Right. Yeah. No, and that's... that's right. And we had a workshop here in July where Arvidsson talked about this paper, and Dick Cadison raised his hand at the end, and in his way of asking a question sort of really told a story. But the upshot of his comment was that he doesn't trust direct integral arguments. He's seen a lot of very good people use direct integral arguments and make serious mistakes, and he'd like to see a proof with without that. And he says, of course, I know you're very careful, Bill, he says, and I'm sure that it's all right, but no, I don't trust it. Yeah. And Bill replied, of course, that he's been trying for 40 years to find this other proof and doesn't know where it is. Okay. So let's go back to the function algebra case and see how this proves it there. All right, so we have this theorem of Shelov. Okay. Which is that we have a function algebra. So you got the constant function 1 contained in A contained in C of X, separates points. Then there exists a unique closed subset Y of X, so that this restriction map is isometric, and two, if RW mapping F to F restricted to W is isometric, that implies W is bigger than Y, so it's the minimal one. Okay. So the proof, well, we have A, and we have it sitting in an isometric way. This is isometric. And therefore, it's completely isometric because of a theorem of Steinspring. We actually didn't do this, but... it's not so hard to show, because you just do it by point evaluations, and you have to show that a linear functional, which is, it has CB norm equal to its norm, and that's an exercise, okay? So this map is isometric, so it's completely isometric. We have this map into A, the C star envelope, and we get a certain star homomorphism pi from C of X onto A. So in particular, A is commutative. Okay, so A is commutative. So A is say C of some Z. And this map pi, the way you can map homomorphism from one C of X onto another, has to come from a map that goes the other way. It has to exist a map H from Z back into X, so that pi of F is F composed of H. Okay. And this is the C star algebra, so I call that J, of J of A. So that means that by the Stone-Weierstrass theorem, I mean J of A has to separate points. Separates points of Z. And that means that H is 1 to 1. Because if it mapped two points to the same one, then it would not be 1 to 1, okay? All right? So what's the space y? Y is h of z. That's what y is going to be. Alright, so now I have to suppose I have another one. Suppose I have W with that property, right? So I have A, and then I have this restriction map to into C of W. And suppose this is isometric. So therefore completely isometric. Right. I have my map J, and I can identify that. I can think of this as now C of Y because this map H is 1-to-1. I can identify C of Z and C of Y. So let's think of it as C of Y now. Okay. And then we know that there's this map tau star homomorphism of W. C of W onto C of Y. Okay. So again, there has to be a map going the other way. Let's call it H prime from Y into W. I should have kept it as Z. That would probably be better. But it's too late now. Okay. So that tau of F is F composed with H prime. Okay. All right. So this function, right? So we, yeah. But this is also, right? Okay. But this is equal to F restricted to Y. And therefore, this H prime has to be the identity on Y. It's the only function, because this function algebra separates points, right? The only place you can send a point y and y that takes the same values is itself. Okay. I think I didn't explain that very well, but anyway. There it is. Okay. I'm not going to do the injective envelope, so which is the other approach, the original approach to constructing the C-star envelope. That's going to have to wait till next time. But instead, I'm going to do some background material that we'll need next time.
So here we're going to stop and put something called commutative C-star envelope in some way.
Well, he proved the existence of Y. He did not prove it this way.
But here, still, we want to know that A must be commutative. Because here, you do use the extra constructor. Did not say that A must be commutative.
Well,
that the C-star envelope should be commutative.
No, he didn't say that.
But even here,
but that is
we know the A to say and extra C-star algebra. But why is it commutative?
Because it's... it follows from what the C-star envelope is. It has to be a quotient of that C of X. I mean... And it's not true that every commutative operator algebra has a commutative C-star envelope. In fact, that's completely false. There are three-dimensional commutative unital algebras generated by three commuting idempotents, where the C-star envelope is has no finite dimensional representations at all. Okay, I mean, it's very non-commutative in general. It's only in the function algebra case you get this. Okay. All right. I want to say a little bit about concrete operator spaces. As opposed to abstract ones, which we will have to see a little bit above later. So it's definition, a concrete operator space is a closed subspace of a C-star algebra. That's it. Okay. All right. So if I have M subspace of a C-star algebra B, now let's take it A, C-star algebra A, then you get a family of matrix norms. You can take Mn of M, and this is contained in Mn of A, and we know that this is a C-star algebra, has a unique C-star algebra norm. This induces a family of norms on Mn of A, Mn of M. Okay. And if I have a map C from M into B of H, say, then again I can in the same way we did for completely positive maps, phi tensor identity n, let me call that phi n, will map Mn of M into Mn of B of H, which is B of Hn, by phi n of a matrix. Mij is the matrix's entries are phi of Mij. Okay. And then we say that phi is completely bounded if the sup over all those norms is finite. Okay. So the CB norm is the sup and if that's finite we call it completely bounded and it's also completely contractive if that's less than or equal to 1. Okay? And so here's a simple lemma that allows us to prove a lot of things about operator spaces by doing things about operator systems. So if I have M contained in A, all right, C mapping M into some C-star algebra B, linear map, okay, then let SM be the following subspace of the 2x2 matrices. I put scale, these would be, let's say A and B unital. Put scalar multiples of identity down the diagonal. Put elements of M in the upper right-hand corner. Put the adjoints of elements of M in the lower left-hand corner. So now we have a self-adjoint unital subspace. So this is an operator system. Okay. And this sits inside M2 of A. Okay. And you can define C from SM into M2 of B in the obvious way, by phi of lambda A B star mu should equal lambda phi of A phi of B star mu. Okay. The obvious way to extend it if we were looking for a completely positive thing. Okay. Then phi is completely contractive if and only if capital C is completely positive. Okay. And the proof, well, this direction is trivial. C is completely positive and unital. So you have that C, little c CB is less than or equal to big C CB, which is big C of 1, the identity, which is 1. Okay, so this is the interesting direction. Okay. So suppose I have a positive matrix in, take MN of SM plus. And suppose I have some positive thing in there. So then by N matrix with entries Sij, and the Sijs look like little 2 by 2 matrices with lambda ij, aij, bij, bij star, mu ij. And then we do what Paulson calls the canonical shuffle. Instead of thinking this as an n by n matrix of 2 by 2 entries, we can think of it as a 2 by 2 matrix with n by n entries, where all of the 1 1 entries come from the 1 1 entries of every matrix, etc. So this looks like unitary equivalence to the matrix H, which is this matrix lambda ij, A, which is the matrix aij, K, which is the matrix mu ij, and the matrix B star, which is this matrix bij star. And of course, it's positive, so this has to be H A A star K. Okay. And when we're computing C of that, if I compute big C N of S, okay, then it's clear that because the map, this map big C leaves the scalars alone, this leaves H and K alone. And what it does here to A is just phi n of A. And down here you have phi n of A star. Okay. And I want to show that if this is positive, then this is positive. That's what I need to show. Well, it would be convenient if H and K were invertible. So if they're not invertible, I'm going to add epsilon times the identity to them. And then I can always let epsilon go to zero afterwards. Okay? So, you know, the shenanigans that make that clear are done in the book. All right. So then you have H A A star K, and I can factor that as square root of H. That's unique positive square root, remember, because it's positive. And I'm going to factor that out on both sides. And then you just see what's left. Identity's there. And here you have h to the minus 1 half, a k to the minus 1 half, and down here you have k to the minus 1 half, a star, h to the minus 1 half. So this is positive. And therefore this is positive. Okay, but it's an easy lemma that says that 1 x x star 1 is positive if and only if x is less than or equal to 1. I'll leave that to you. It's completely elementary. So, and it's if and only if. So this being positive implies that h to the minus 1 half a k to the minus 1 half is a contraction. Now if you think about it, A is a matrix with elements in the subspace M. And h to the minus 1 half and k to the minus 1 half are scalar matrices. So when I multiply it, the entries of this product are linear combinations of the entries of A, so all of those entries belong to M. Okay? So this belongs to Mn of M. C, by hypothesis, is completely contractive. So therefore, Cn of h to the minus 1 half a k to the minus 1 half is less than or equal to 1. Okay. But again, if you unwind what's happening here, this is just expressing the entries of the product as linear combinations of the entries in here. This is equal to h to the minus 1 half Cn of A k to the minus 1 half. So that's less than or equal to 1. Okay. So therefore, the matrix that has identity, h to the minus 1 half, phi n of A, k to the minus 1 half, k to the minus 1 half, phi n of A, star, h to the minus 1 half, identity is positive. Now multiply it on both sides by h to the 1 half, k to the 1 half, and that will also be positive, but when you multiply that out, you get h phi n of A, phi n of A star, k, which is phi of S. And so this is positive. Okay. So that proves the lemma, and I seem to run out of time. I wanted to do Wittstock's ascension theorem, so let me do it, because that'll give a good starting place for next time. So Wittstock's extension theorem is just like Arvidsson's extension theorem, except it works for operator spaces. So I have M contained in A C star algebra. I have a map C into B of H, completely bounded. There exists an extension phi tilde. Phi tilde CB equals the norm of CCD. So that's Wittstock's extension theorem. And the proof, well, scale so that CCB is exactly 1, and then I want to dilate it to a completely contractive 1. Okay? And then, so I apply this trick and I get SM in this map big C into M2 of B of H, which is B of H2. Okay, and this sits inside of M2 of A. There exists this map phi twiddle, completely positive. This is completely positive and unital. By Arvidsson's extension theorem, phi twiddle CB is equal to the norm of phi twiddle of 1 because it's completely positive, which is 1 because it's unital. Okay, because this map, this map and this lemma is unital. Okay, and then the extension of then phi twiddle, then you write that phi of the matrix 0, A, 0, 0 is equal to who knows, who cares what in these places, and this is your phi twiddle here. You just compress it to that corner. And that's going to be completely contractive because it's a corner of a completely contractive thing, and it extends it because that's how the map worked there. And that's where I'm stopping.